This is a download from the BBC. To download other programmes or for more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live.
Glenn Brownlee.
Yes.
Says, this is difficult. It looks like Dear Huffraher and...
That's Huffraher. That's a reference to, and it'll be Amelma Hay, won't it?
It is, one? Yeah.
Well done.
What's that a reference
it's
to?
It's a reference to the man with two brains.
Okay.
Because...
Dear Huffraher and Amelma Hay.
If you remember, the way it works out is that Steve Martin plays a Dr. Huffraher... And he falls in love with the disembodied brain of Amelia Hermelmahoy. Right.
Greetings from San Francisco, says Glenn, where the weather is better than the UK, but the cinema audiences have low IQs, and I have to search long and hard to find good films such as Slumdog Squarepants. I'm delighted to say that Taken is finally being released here this weekend. Ever since turning into the review on the podcast, I've been waiting for this film to come out.
Since tuning into the review, not turning into the review, no, you pea brain.
No, not at all. I've been waiting for this film to come out just to see the policeman with the baguette and other assorted insults, if you remember that. You remember that's how you know he's French, because he walks around with a baguette under his arm. Genuinely. My excitement has... really been building for the past 2 weeks since the TV trailers began, especially as they're the skills that make me a nightmare to people like you clip. It really does look absolutely awful, way worse than I could have imagined, and therefore is likely to be a huge hit in the US. I'm amazed it hasn't come out.
So
now I have a dilemma. Should I go ahead with my plan to see this movie in all its stereotyping terribleness just to see how bad it could be, or do I decide that giving money to the makers of this kind of thing is just plain wrong and I should wait and till I see it on illegal DVD copy obtained from a dodgy-looking Mexican who promises never to pass anything on to the inbred insular Americans who turn out this kind of bilge.
Well, I think as we established when we reviewed Taken, I mean, it's perfectly good fun. It's a stupid nuts-and-bolts B-movie that happens to have been elevated to A-movie status by the presence of Liam Neeson. The only thing that was remarkable about it is that Liam Neeson came in and did that interview with you in which he...
mumbled and grumbled his way through
three and a half minutes. And yet, in the movie, he plays the man who says, I'm the man with the kind of skills who makes life very, very bad for me. Go and see it. Go and see it and ask yourself at the end who's driving the boat.
P.S. One advantage, he adds provocatively, of moving from the UK to the USA is that there's no chance of seeing a depressing and boring black and white movie about Liverpool. Anyway, surprisingly, more correspondence on Taken. Simon and Mark, I thought you'd like this. This is Anthony Lane reviewing Taken.
Oh, yeah. So Taken is genuinely just opening in the America.
This is from in the Americas.
In the Americas.
In the colonies.
Yes.
Tanya says, this is from Anthony Lane. Kim and a friend leave for a vacation in Europe where, ignoring the advice of her father, they're abducted with such consummate speed that it might have been simpler if he'd FedExed them directly to the kidnappers. Pausing only to borrow a private jet from his ex's slimy husband, Mills flies to Paris where he proceeds to work his way without mercy through a personal alphabet of undesirable aliens. This being a brisk affair, of little more than 90 minutes, he only gets as far as Albanians and Arabs. But if I were an innocent Bermudan, let alone a Belgian, I'd start to get nervous about a sequel.
That's good, isn't it? Anthony Lane is a very funny film review.
He's got a nice
turn of phrase.
We've got a whole bunch of emails this week from Australia. Simon Donald, orthopaedic registrar at St George's Hospital.
Yes.
Dear Saint and Greavesy, greetings from Sydney. Having heard Mark's review of The Wrestler, and mentioning The Wrestler because it's not in the top 10.
Yeah, okay. That must be because it's on
limited
release. Like, I mean, you know, that must be the deal. I mean, it's certainly the adverts are out for it, but I think it's what you'd call it must be a platform release in key cities, and then presumably it'll go nationwide after that.
Okay, anyway, it's not there, so it's just some people who've seen The rest they just want to talk about. Went and saw said movie last night. Spot on worthy Oscar nods for Tomei and Rourke. The film did drag a little with a side story with his daughter, but it was the movie that last year's Rocky Balboa could and should have been.
Yeah, but wasn't. But I did quite enjoy Rocky Balboa, but I absolutely hated Rambo, John Rambo.
Why is there a gap, he then adds, why is there a gap of several months? We're just talking about for the gap with Taken, but why is there a gap of several months in a film's release between countries for some films, but not in others? For example, Australia.
Yes. All of it.
Is what he puts in brackets.
Sorry, all of it.
Came out here and in the US more than a month before it did back home, and Wall-E in reverse, whereas films like Lord of the Rings had simultaneous releases. Dr. K, please explain.
Okay, well, oddly enough, there is a partial answer to this. There are certain companies In Britain, one of them is a distribution company called Entertainment, who have distributed films like from companies like New Line. There are certain companies who favour the single release date on the grounds that it minimises piracy. If you look at what happens with the release of Bollywood movies, for example, they almost always go day and date internationally, because the suggestion is that as soon as they've opened in one place, the possibility of piracy is great, and consequently, if you open them everywhere at the same time, you minimise that. And that is why you are, with most of those Bollywood releases, the only chance that the British press get to see them is in the national press show in the week of release. And there are other, like, for example, Underworld was another. Actually, Underworld wasn't press screened at all, was it? Underworld, the most recent one, wasn't press screened at all. But there are some companies. Rise of the Lycans, yes, that's right. So there are some companies who, it's just a policy, which is that you release day and date, and it's partly because, or at least the idea is partly that it's to do with piracy. I mean, whether or not that actually works, whether it actually works as an impediment to piracy, I don't know, but that's the case. Other movies are distributed different, you know, by obviously different countries and different companies in different territories, and they plan their release strategies around the idea of taking the cast and crew from one place to another, so they stagger the releases. I mean, it used to be the case that in America, the window between America and Britain of opening was something like 6 months on, you know, in general. And then Clockwork Orange, you know, the Kubrick film, was square walled into London for a year before it came out into, you know, into the rest of the country. You could only see it in London for about a year.
Let's do a box office top 10 and then we'll get into some reviews. Madagascar Escape to Africa is at number 10.
Remarkable only because it's still in there. So it's, you know, obviously it's now, presumably this is the final week that we're going to see it, but remarkable only that it's still in there.
Frost Nixon at 9. Mike in Aberdeen went to see this film this week, really enjoyed it, but was left wondering if Matthew McFadden intended to play John Burt as Richard Madeley. I've luckily only heard one of Burt's blue sky thinking, so don't know if it was an accurate portrayal or not.
I thought you'd finish, but I'll wait till you finish.
David Martin, BA Honours, Media and Cultural Studies and Film Studies, saw Frost Nixon yesterday, couldn't help but be struck by how it's Rocky in armchairs.
Yes, and they've said that themselves. I mean, actually, that is how it was described by Ron Howard.
Frost is the underdog, spending most of the film out of his depth and being a laughingstock, whilst Nixon is Apollo Creed, supremely confident and thinking he can use Frost to boost his profile. Then, like Rocky, there is a montage, except instead of running up steps and punching meat, Frost circles lots of dates and quotes. Then they have a big face-off, and Frost surprises everyone by getting the confession out of Nixon. Instead of going 12 rounds with Creed, I'm aware that Rocky was a draw, all it's missing is Frost shouting Caroline after the big interview.
Yeah. Anyway. Because, and of course, that is the thing, is that Rocky doesn't win at the end of Rocky.
Does it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he's a sledge, she's a girl, he's a ghost.
Beverly Hills, Joe Ahern.
No, hang on, I wanted to say something else about Frost Nixon.
Okay, Frost Nixon, yeah, go ahead.
Which I really like it. I really wish that Michael Sheen had been more prominently awarded, because, I mean, I think having, and I've now seen it again, so I've now seen it three times, I think that his performance is every bit as good as Frank Langella's performance, and certainly is, you know, in my opinion, at least half of what's good about the movie. And the one thing that I regret having seen it, of course, is that I did once very briefly meet John Burt at Radio 1. And if I'd known then what I know now, I simply would have said, tell me about meeting Richard Nixon. And I didn't, and my chance is gone.
Dear Haldeman and Ehrlichman, says Phil in London, who adds 3 hours, 33 minutes personal best for the London Marathon.
Very good.
I studied Nixon for a year at university. I confess to having found Frost Nixon less gripping than The Good Doctor. My closeness to the source material kept dragging me out of the film, as I noticed edits and insertions in the film which are not there in the original interviews. Frank Langella's Nixon, whilst brilliant as the proverbial wounded animal, did not invoke the self-pity. There was so much at the heart of Nixon's psyche, such an important part in his downfall. I could not help thinking simply sticking the live interviews up on the screen would have been just as, if not more, gripping. Who is better at doing Nixon than Nixon? Rewatching them this week has only confirmed that view for me.
And of course, famously, the scene which everybody talks about after they've seen Frost Nixon, the scene in which Nixon rings Frost up in the middle of the night and says to him, you know, this is it, it's all or nothing, didn't happen. But of course, it's been explained away by Peter Morgan by saying that Nixon did indeed make late night phone calls when he was in his cups, and so therefore it was a dramatic event. Personally, I could lose that scene. I know it's everyone's favourite scene in the film, but I could lose that sequence. I don't need it.
So
go back and redo it, and come back when you've got it better.
Beverly Hills, Chihuahua at number 8.
I mean, obviously rubbish, but I would be completely lying if I said that I didn't laugh at the scene in which all the little Chihuahuas stand up in the Mayan temples and do the whole speech about we are not just handbag accessories. I did find that funny.
Bride Wars at 7.
Didn't find it funny at all. It's grotesque that it's still in the charts, and if you've been to see it, then shame on you.
And everyone involved, in fact, should be thoroughly ashamed of themselves. Role Models at 6.
Well, as we know, it's genius, isn't it? It's packed with big belly laughs.
And in fact, James King.
I had a ding dong with James. I went to a screening and he was there, and he was sitting next to Edith Bowman from Radio 1, who he works with on Radio 1. And I gave him a right earful. I said, I can't believe that you're credited on that poster for saying that thing. And he was saying he meant genius in the kids' sense of the word.
Yeah.
I said, yeah, but then, James, you're over 30, so therefore you're no longer able to pull that off. Well, apparently there was then much discussion about this on Radio 1 about how this mad person has sat down next to James King and completely bent his ear off. But I am right, and James really should know better.
Underworld, Rise of the Lycans, this week's number 5.
Michael Sheen runs around without his shirt on and looks quite good in a pair of leather trues with those strange stringy strappy things over the where most of us have button flies. Other than that, it's pretty unremarkable. It is generally regarded by the horror fraternity as the best of the underworld movies, but frankly that ain't saying a whole load. I thought it was rubbish.
£7 is at number 4.
And honestly, if anybody has got through £7 and not figured out what the £7 of the title is within the first 15 minutes, please write and let me know, because it is completely meretricious nonsense and it's terribly somber and sober and wants you to think that it's important, but it isn't. And you realise a little bit in what the £7 is that we're not allowed to talk about because we were asked not to, and you think,
what
no,
is
it can't.
Then?
Well, I've been asked not to, so I'm not going to break that promise. That promise of trust, because they said to us...
Who did you promise to?
The distributors.
That doesn't count.
No, well, they hand out a form and say, we'd like other people to be able to enjoy this movie as much as you're about to.
Oh, great.
And so, therefore, you'll spoil the enjoyment if you tell them what the £7 is.
So you haven't spoiled their enjoyment just by telling them that you think it's pants?
No, because that at least still leaves open the possibility. Anybody who's seen it who liked it, let us know.
My Bloody Valentine in 3D at 3.
Yes, if you are going to see My Bloody Valentine, the remake, 3D is probably the only way to do it. I have figured out my problem with 3D. Have I explained this to you?
Or is it brief?
It is brief. You had a whole afternoon discussion about 3D.
I know, but you weren't part of that.
No, but would you like to hear my tuppence worth?
In a sentence.
Okay. Here's the problem with 3D.
Just a short sentence.
Yeah. 3D is meant to be an immersive experience that brings you into the drama. In fact, the thing that it does, particularly in the case of Bloody Valentine, is it just points things at you. It's very good at pointing at you out of the screen.
You're waving your arms towards it in a very scary way.
No, but that's it. It's all this. Whoa. It's all, whoa. But what it's not good at is, ooh, bringing you in. So, I was in the middle of Bloody Valentine, which is set down a mine, which is meant to be the most immersive experience. And I went, that's it. It's all to do with it coming. Now, I know we'll review Bolt next week. And there's a greater argument for saying that Bolt is deliberately non-pointy. It's deliberately non-pointy. It's deliberately more immersive. But I still think that in the end, 3D is about people sticking things out at you. Pickaxes, sticks, prongs, whatever it is.
Stop pointing your pen.
But it's not good. That's what 3D is all about.
Valkyrie is at number... You've had enough time now. I said one sentence. I have a whole paragraph. Valkyrie is at 2?
Well... The Valkyrie accent issue continues to run and run. Why is Tom Cruise speaking American? Why are the British actors speaking British, except for Eddie Izzard, who's doing a little bit like that? And in the end, the only way of solving the Valkyrie, because I actually quite like Valkyrie, I think it's a good nuts and bolts thriller, considering that you know what the outcome of it is. You know what? They didn't kill Hitler. Sorry if that spoiled it for anybody. The only way of solving the problem that they have with the accent melange would be to do it in German. And I'm becoming increasingly of the opinion that is, in fact, the only solution.
Just
do the movies in the language in which they're in. Mel Gibson did it. You know, if it'd be Passion of the Christ and Apocalypto, and Clint Eastwood did it with the Iwo Jima movie. You know, it's all doable. So come on, let's draw a line underneath the accent issue and just do it in the proper language. Actors just tell you the whole time how much they love immersing themselves in a role. You know what would really immerse you in a role? Learn the language.
Done.
Yeah.
Just a couple of emails about the number one movie, which is still Slumdog Millionaire. This is Nicholas Scrivens. Dear Simpson and Bruckheimer, who do you want to be?
Oh, I'm definitely Don Simpson. I'm so definitely Don Simpson.
Just been to see Slumdog Millionaire, which of course is the way it's pronounced in the film, even though I got it wrong, and loved it. Not the greatest of Danny Boyle fans since Trainspotting, but really loved the movie. The pitch-perfect editing and acting. My question is Oscar-related. If Johnny Greenwood's excellent score for There Will Be Blood was deemed to be outside the rules of the Academy because it contained pre-existing music...
Yes.
How is it that A.R. Rahman gets a nomination for Slam Dunk when the score uses the theme of Who Wants to Be a Millionaire? At first, I thought this might be because the millionaire theme was used in a diegetic way.
Yeah, well,
I looked it up, meaning narrative,
meaning,
from diegesis.
Meaning of the fiction.
Of the narrative.
But do you know what exegetic is?
But deep
it's the opposite of that.
Thanks. But deep into Act 3, when our heroine is rushing across town to meet our hero, we hear the theme in a non-diegetic way. Who stitched Mr. Greenwood up? Surely rules is rules.
Actually, there's a very interesting answer to that. On the subject of the millionaire theme tuner, but it's not that you can never have any other bits of music in the thing. And obviously, if I don't remember the particular scene you're talking about, but that will be taken as a quotation. That's absolutely fine. That's quoting a theme. However, the question of who stitched Mr. Greenwood up is very interesting because there was an awful lot of talk about, you know, who was it? And there was much suggestion that it was disgruntled people who thought that he might win if he got qualified. I mean, it's absolutely right that he really should have won for There Will Be Blood, because I cannot think of a movie of that year in which the music was more important. Why are you rolling your eyes into your head?
Because Louise is waiting very patiently to do some travel.
She's interested.
I am.
Are you interested?
I love Fridays.
Where do you stand on exegetic and diegetic
music?
It's
also 3:21 and we're late, and I just do one more email on...
Oh, don't let me hold you up. It's all right for you to hold her up, but not for me.
No, that's right. Dear Simon, I fear the disciples of the Good Doctor are now setting up ministries in faraway places. Says Simon Harris, who's a POM on holiday in Australia. I personally followed the Good Doctor's advice and saw Slumdog Millionaire in the cinema adjacent to the Opera House in Sydney. I knew there were a few POMs in the audience, as about five or six people laughed at the cat returning to Alfie joke, which is part of the sequence in the call centre. As I was leaving this fantastic must-see film, a lady in front of me said to her partner in a broad Aussie accent, "That would never happen." As I was thinking what she said, about what she said, a stranger with a West Country accent butted in and said, "It's a fable." Quick as a flash, I replied, and it was the rebirth of narrative cinema. I got a round of applause from all the people around the West Country man. The Aussie woman looked on somewhat confused. Meanwhile, all the POMs ended up in a bar debating all things movie.
Excellent.
So there you go.
Very good.
The influence is stretching to the other side of the world.
I think we should start with JCVD since...
Jean-Claude Van Damme, the movie.
No, it's just called JCVD.
JCVD.
Or, alternative title, Codename JCVD.
All we'll be explaining in just a moment. And Nick in New Jersey, very fast, about Of Time in the City. He says it is playing in the United States.
Yay!
It's currently in New York at One Lonely Art House for the last 2 weeks.
Very good.
An awful lot of correspondence about Underworld. So if we have time before the end of the break, I want to go back to Underworld. But let's get some reviews done first of all, because what an exciting place to start.
JCVD, which is, as we said, Jean-Claude Van Damme, who is one of three only famous things to come out of Belgium, along with Plastic Bertrand and Tintin.
See the movie very soon. What an interesting cast they have lined up.
Interesting enough, being filmed in 3D. There'll be lots of pointing. There'll be lots of Tintin's hair pointing at you. Okay, so JCVD is this. Jean-Claude Van Damme plays Jean-Claude Van Damme. At the beginning of the movie, we see him in action.
Convincingly? Or not?
We see him in action mode. He's in the middle of an action sequence. He has a whole bunch of stuff. You know, it's an action sequence. It's clearly not. You know, it's a film set. And then, the big reveal is it's a film set. Fine. And then he complains about having to do it all in one take because he's in his late 40s. And then there are other scenes cut in which demonstrate he's having a kind of custody battle and things are falling apart and his agent's having a bad time. And then he goes to a sort of post office banky place and he goes into it. And the next thing you know, there's a raid and there's a whole hostage situation going on, and Jean-Claude is inside. The public on the outside think that Jean-Claude is actually raiding, doing the post office raid because he needs money in order to fight the custody battle. But again, he's famous, so they're all standing outside cheering. You know, kind of imagine like Serpico, but a kind of reality TV show starring a Belgian guy who was famous for doing martial arts. So Jean-Claude Van Damme playing a movie in which he sort of, you know, picks apart in a postmodern fashion the difficulty of being Jean-Claude Van Damme, the action star known only for his high kick and ability to do the splits, but not for his fantastic intellectual take on the world, which is, you know, which now there have been a couple of newspaper reports. One person said this, Van Damme demolishes the wall between fiction and real life in a performance that easily bears comparison with Mickey Rourke's portrayal of an aging fighter in The Wrestler. Well, let's be absolutely clear about this. And I mean, I quite enjoyed JCVD, but no, it doesn't. Okay, Mickey Rourke is, you know, nominated for Best Actor for The Wrestler, and I think it odds on that he's going to win for it. There's no possibility of Jean-Claude Van Damme being nominated for anything other than washed-up action star, most unlikely to star in a reality-style semi-art house movie. Oh, there he is doing it. That's quite interesting. But bear in mind, this is not anything fantastically new. Do you remember Arnold Schwarzenegger made that movie, The Last Action Hero?
Yep.
You remember the plot of that? It was kind of, it's a Pirandello.
I never
sort of,
liked it. See,
no, but
we've argued about this before. You really liked that film.
I did like it. Yeah, and the deal was that there's somebody in a fictional world, and all the people who are in the fictional world realise that they're in a fictional world, and he is a fictional character, and he's playing effectively a character who is easy to mix them up, who is Arnold Schwarzenegger. So it's like a sort of look. Here I am. I am the Terminator, but I know that I'm. I understand. There's an inside and an outside. The movie didn't do very well, but it was essentially a kind of look at me. This is the real thing. This the other thing that's going on. There was also a very interesting moment in action hero status in which I got it spectacularly wrong, in which there was...
Say that again?
I got it spectacularly wrong.
Thank you.
Jean-Claude Van Damme, Arnold Schwarzenegger and Dolph Lundgren, okay? All of whom were martial arts sort of, you know, flexible people. You know, they did a lot of flexing. They flexed up here and they flexed down there and they did a lot of flexing and all that sort of stuff. But the thing was, they all had European-y accents and they all wanted to break big in Hollywood. And the big, you know, thing about Hollywood is that, you know, you have to have an American accent, unless, of course, you're going to be in a movie like The Leader, in which case, you know, it'd be quite good if you can do a little bit of this, because then you get a role with Kate Winslet in the boss. Ha ha ha. Anyway, so I said in Time Out, Dolph Lundgren was the guy to watch because he had a better American accent than either Jean-Claude Van Damme or Arnold Schwarzenegger. Well, Jean-Claude Van Damme is currently being sort of feted as kind of art house darling as a result of JCVD. Meanwhile, Arnold Schwarzenegger went on to be the governor of California after having realised that the way he was going to sort out his movie career wasn't by changing his accent, but by going from being a robot killing machine villain to being a robot killing machine hero, to playing a comedy star in things like Twins, to then actually playing a mother. Do you remember he plays a mother in that film, Junior? He gets pregnant. He plays a man who gets pregnant. So what he was basically doing was he was bolting on the bits of his character that weren't there. I mean, it was like an incredible sort of cyborg thing. I am unlikable and, you know, what should I do? I know I should have some comedy. Here is some comedy. I should have some motherhood. Here is some motherhood. Oh, look, I'm a Kennedy. I'm the governor of California. So he did that. Meanwhile, Dolph Lundgren disappeared off the map, right? Jean-Claude Van Damme, however, according to this movie, and it's a real item because I haven't seen Jean-Claude Van Damme on screen for quite a long time, he apparently holds some chippiness about the fact that he brought John Woo to Hollywood and then didn't end up starring in any more John Woo movies, because there's a couple of bits in the movie in which people say, yeah, he brought John Woo to Hollywood and look what happened to him. The most audacious sequence in the film, which is the one that is basically kind of pulled the wool over everybody's eyes and made everybody think that, in fact, this is a great art house movie, when it isn't, it's just a self-reflexive postmodern romp. Jean-Claude Van Damme is in this hostage situation when everybody on the outside thinks he's holding out the back, and suddenly his chair, right? I'm going to do this, right? His chair goes up in the air like this. So it goes up like that, and he starts floating up into the sky, and he floats, and his head floats up, and he floats up above the scene, and then he's in amidst the lights, right? And it's a device. It's a Brechtian device saying, look, it's a movie. And then...
A Brechtian device?
Yeah.
How often do you get those?
How would, well, Brecht's got them quite a lot, yeah, but you don't get them that
often. How do you spot a Brechtian device?
Breaking down the fourth wall.
That's what it is.
It is. Audience alienation. It's just saying, look, it's a play. It's a you know, it's not real. You know what? I know it's a play. Do you know why I know it's a play? Because I walked into a theatre box office and paid £5 to get in. That's how I know it's a play. That's why Brechtian devices don't cut the mustard with me. I know the difference between fiction and reality. Okay, sorry. There we go. But, so he goes up and thinks, and then there is a...
Is he still riding the Brechtian device now?
Yeah.
He's still doing it?
Yeah. So right. he's on the thing, right? The thing goes up into the lights, right? And Jean-Claude does a 7-minute straight-to-camera monologue in which he complains about how hard it is to be Jean-Claude Van Damme. Obviously, he does it in Belgian. I'm now going to do a cod impression of it in English with a Belgian accent in the manner of Kate Winslet in The Reader. And he says, you know, it's very hard because, you know, I'm doing all this stuff. I can't speak American properly, but then I come over here and then all the stuff, bad stuff. And then I start going around hotels in the world and then they start saying, oh, but he doesn't know anything and he takes all these things and what is happening? Oh, it's very, believe me, it's very hard to be Jean-Claude Van Damme. And he goes, for 7 minutes, he has a whinge. He has a whinge of the kind...
That was the French voice. voice that John Cleese used when over the parapets in Monty Python and the Holy Grail.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. There is just in your general direction. Exactly. Your mother was a hamster and your father smelt of elderberries. Now go away or I shall taunt you a second time.
People don't, anyway, no, people don't pay their license fee to hear two middle-aged men doing Monty Python
sketches. No, but the key thing is that people said, oh, it's a magnificent scene. It's so brave. It's Jean-Claude. No, you know what would be brave? Is making fun of himself. Actually, it's not that brave to sit up in the rafters and have a moan about how hard it's been to be Jean-Claude Van Damme and have a kind of, you know, oh, well, everyone got at me because I did all these things. And then he said, you know, what have I done? I've done nothing. And part of me is going, yeah, no, you haven't really, but you can do the splits, or you used to be able to. And then he comes back down again. And then the thing has a kind of straightforward action movie climax with the postmodern thing that is. So, in short, it's all right. It's certainly the most interesting thing he's done in a long time, but it's not the great art house triumph that everybody's saying it is.
Simon in Epworth says, sounds like JCVD should be renamed JC straight to DVD.
In fact, it is coming to DVD very fast. I mean, there is a certain enjoyment in seeing Jean-Claude Van Damme do it, but it is just like another one of the... I'll tell you what it would be like. It's like him going on a reality TV programme. And in these days when we've seen, some other people have seen all those famous people going into reality TV shows and being themselves, you know, like, what's the name of the guy from the Austin Powers movie? He's on Big Brother at the moment, isn't he?
Vern Troyer.
Him?
Yeah.
So his name, fine. Well,
finished a while back. Yeah, go on.
Okay, but in an age... last week, that's quite recent. In an age in which everyone's seen that, the idea of Jean-Claude Van Damme sitting on a crane complaining... Isn't that? And in fact, it would be better if he made more of a kind of, you know what, I'm rubbish and I'm farcical. But all he does is he says, I haven't done anything, and then he cries a little bit.
Belgians want to say that they have also contributed other things which you didn't mention. Jacques Brel, Hercule Poirot, The Singing Nun, Mannequin P, and let's not forget some of the most fantastic beer that you can get. So, and also the great
thing
about
Belgian beer.
The great thing about Belgian beer is you have to serve it in the right glass, and when you buy it, particularly the Trappist beer, it has little illustrations. So you can't serve it in a glass this shape. It has got a line through it. This is the shape glass that you should actually serve it.
Well, it's got to be a half pint glass because it's so strong usually.
They don't use pints, do they? They use litre measurements.
No son of mine drinks in 3/4 millilitres.
Anyway, more on this in just a moment. What's going to come next? Anything that?
Yeah, Revolutionary Road.
Oh, at last, we're going to get to the thing.
No, JCVD is the thing. Look, I watched it. All right.
So
it's as Barry Manilow said, I lived through my music. Now, you know, I hope you can live through it too.
Revolutionary Road.
I suffered for my art. Now it's your turn.
To be debated in just a moment. mayo@bbc.co.uk. Which is the finest Belgian beer, would you say?
Fruit beers are lovely.
No, you don't drink beer to have a fruit flavour.
Is it fruit girl? Yeah, fruit beer. They have strawberry beer. Leffert's and raspberry beer. Leffert do raspberry beer, which
that's
is
girls'
great.
Beer.
There's a restaurant where they serve you dressed as monks. That. There is a Belgian restaurant chain, isn't there? It's called Belgian or something, or Belgian.
It's original, isn't it?
Belgo. No,
in which Belgo, you get served, Belgo, there we go, in which you get served by people dressed as monks.
Not good for lunch, though, because it is, as George said, unbelievably strong. Anyway,
American lager is the...
Fruit beer isn't for men.
No,
it's for girls.
George, have you ever had a fruit beer?
I've sampled.
Sounds like I'm sorry then.
Were you lining that one up a bit?
No,
I have sampled.
You don't have a beer that tastes of strawberry. What do you have a beer that tastes of strawberry for? What would
maybe beer. It does taste of beer as well, to be fair. But it is a girl's beer, I'm quite
maybe
happy
if you've
to
had too much the night before and you don't want something that tastes of beer. Want something that tastes of strawberry.
Simon, put a lager in black.
Thank you. Just line them up. Okay, we'll do Revolutionary Road in just a minute, unless we're off on some ridiculous tangent.
I once went into a pub and I asked for a pint of lager. And a pint of cider, and they refused to serve it to me because they said, we don't serve snake bite. I said, I don't want snake bite. I want a pint of lager and the pint of cider. They said, not on the same table. They actually thought we'd chemically mix snake bite.
Revolutionary Road to be discussed next. Matt Hill says, dear Sony and BPG, there are clear similarities between David Attenborough, who was on between 2 and 3 o'clock, and the good Dr. Kermode. The former is undoubtedly the greatest broadcaster ever, while the latter is also on your show. It's quite good, I thought. I bet David Attenborough likes The Big Lebowski, he adds. And should the wife and I go and see Frost Nixon or The Reader this weekend?
Frost Nixon.
Ian says, dear Neil Young and Crazy Horse, usually a podcast listener, I'll be Neil Young, you could be Crazy Horse. Okay. I'm relishing the delicious flavour of a live listen. So I thought I'd email to describe the diabolical experience of being forced to endure bride wars this week. I'm getting married in July. This was the last thing I needed. Both misogynistic and man-hating at once. Nothing in this hideous film was palatable. And I actually had to hold my head in my hands at the end. Even worse than Juice Bigelow, European Gigolo. which I was forced
to really
watch
saying something.
As the only English language film on Saudi Arabian cable earlier this year. Did Rolling Hand and Cinnamon Carter, The Good Doctor, just claimed that you can't be nominated twice in the same Oscar category.
Just read out an email that said that.
Then what about Steven Soderbergh, nominated for Best Director of Traffic and Darren Brockovich in the same year?
No. Apparently, it's and again, Colin was saying this. Apparently, it is only it's the acting categories that applies to. I make no bones about this. I don't understand the Academy rules, as I think would be apparent. But this is the this is what I've been told by Colin, and also by that email. I think you're quite right.
Luke in Knots, £7, saw the trailer, worked it out, checked I was right on Wikipedia, was rubbish.
Rubbish.
Hello to David Morrissey, who I saw this week again, even younger, looks about 25 at the moment. Jason Isaacs.
Hello to Jason Isaacs.
Stephen Fry. Hello, Stephen Fry. All members of Focus.
Charlotte from the Subways.
Fairport Convention. And Michael Sheen.
Yep. Hello to all members of the Sway pantomime.
Since when did they get included?
Since they opened on Wednesday night and it was rip-roaring fun.
A pantomime that starts at the end of January.
Yeah, that's when pantomimes happen.
Well, they most start before Christmas,
nope.
I think.
No, I think you'll find most start after Christmas.
Since when?
Since ever. Pantomimes happen after Christmas, not before
anyway,
Christmas.
Anyway, Revolutionary Road is out. Tell us about it, Good Doctor.
Well, can it be as good as the Sway pantomime? It's going to be hard, because it was great. OK, Sam Mendes' adaptation of a Richard Yates novel. The story is, there was a lovely review by Roger Ebert, who said that, effectively, it is the story of the unhappy marriage that would have followed had Kate Winslet and Leonardo DiCaprio not been tragically separated at the end of Titanic, because this is what becomes of marriages that are built purely on romance and nothing else. They're a couple in the 1950s. He does some office job that's fairly pointless. She's tied up with domesticity and, you know, suffering internally. And she realises that everything is falling apart. And she has a revolutionary idea on Revolutionary Road. That, in fact, what they should do is pack it all in and up stumps to Paris, to Gay Paris, which is where he always thought, you know, all the most exciting things were happening. She says, look, you know, we're completely in a rut here. Let's pack it. Let's just go. I will support you. You can do the thing you really want to do. And he says, I don't know what that is. And she says, but the point is you'll discover it. You'll discover it in Paris when you're sitting there with all the cafe culture and people on bicycles and baguettes and Liam Neeson running around with a huge semi-automatic weapon. You'll discover what it is that you need. But, of course, their non-revolutionary and very reactionary neighbours are shocked.
You know what this is like, April? Honestly. Just talking like this. The whole idea of going off to Europe this way. This is the way I felt going up to the line the first time in the war. I mean, I was probably just as scared as everyone else, but inside, I never felt better. I felt alive. I felt full of blood. I felt everything seemed more real. The guys in their uniforms, the snow on the fields, the trees, and all of us just walking. I mean, I was scared, of course, but I just kept thinking, this is it, you know? This is the truth.
I felt that way once, too.
When?
The first time you made love to me.
I want to thank everybody. Is this really happening? Oh, I got all of you. Gather.
Are we still in the clip?
No, yeah, well,
oh,
you know,
we're
slipping seamlessly from one to the other, okay?
Oh, now, I couldn't spot the joy in there.
Of course, what happens is they don't. The plan looks like it's going to happen, but then all these things start weighing down on them. So will they actually make that escape to Paris and get out of the horrible, you know, grimy life that they're living?
I don't know. What's the answer?
Well, I can't tell you. That'll be the end of the thing, although I think you can pretty much fill in the dots for yourself. Now, look, here's on the plus side, okay? So directed by Sam Mendes, did American Beauty, and he's kind of back in the same territory of that sort of looking askance at uptight American suburban life.
What does that look like?
What does it look like?
If you were to look askance at Louise,
yeah,
for example.
Go, like that. That was askance.
Look kind of suggestive.
No. Well, he's not looking suggestively at
American. I think he just made a pass. Okay, yeah.
Well, how do you do askance, then?
I don't know. I don't think I've ever looked askance at anything. I don't know how to look askance.
I hate it when you do this.
No,
you're quite right to pick me up on this sort of thing. Alan Frank once wrote a review that said the film doesn't work, and his editor said, do you mean it doesn't go through the projector successfully? And he said, don't use phrases that you don't, you know.
Anyway, carry on.
Anyway, fine. So it looks askance, but at American suburban life. And he's a clearly on home territory in this area, which is funny because obviously he's got an outsider's eye. The performances by Kate Winslet and Leonardo DiCaprio are pretty solid. I far prefer Kate Winslet's performance in this to the performance in The Reader, and the movie itself is far more worthy of a Best Film nod than The Reader is, although frankly I don't think either of them are anything like as great as people are saying. Here's my problem. Well, here's my number of problems. I have seen all of this before. The idea that you know, housewives in the 1950s were having a rubbish time behind the incredible, you know, fabulous to look at exterior is really nothing new. I mean, I think we all know that. I mean, ever since Blue Velvet did the behind the picket fence and the green lawn lies hideous horror and psychological torment and all the rest of it, it's like, yeah, I know. What can you possibly say that hasn't already been said? Also, if you look at a movie like Todd Haynes' Far From Heaven, that did something far more subversive with the sort of the idea of the melodrama and the idea of looking behind what the suburban scene is meant to look like and what's actually underneath. And it did something far more radical and far more interesting and far more surprising. The other thing is that actually one of the best performances in the film is by Michael Shannon, who is Oscar nominated for a supporting actor. And Michael Shannon does a really great job with what is frankly a duff role, which is that he plays the holy fool. He's a guy who's been in an asylum, who's like ahead of the wave and speaks the truth. And he gets into the suburban homes and he starts saying everything that's real. Oh, you're rubbish, he's lying to you, he's doing this, this house is a trap, da 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 da. But the idea of having the holy fool coming in is such a cliched one. It's such an idea about, you know, he's mad, but guess what? They see the truth. It's like, can you not come up with a better device than that? I mean, I understand it's in the sort of the DNA of the story. So in the end, although I think the performances are solid, cinematography is nice, it's all executed with a certain degree of flair, and there's one lovely sequence in it in which Kate Winslet is dancing with her next-door neighbour and everything's starting to fall apart and it goes a bit crazy and you get a kind of sense of fluid cinema about it, it's awfully like, yeah, I know, but you know, in an age in which Mad Men is doing all this stuff but with jokes, I mean, the really radical thing right now would be to see a drama set in the 1950s in which housewives are having an absolutely great time. They think it's fantastic. Look at this, my husband's off at work, I haven't got anything to do at all, I'm just going to have another gin
and smoke 20 cigarettes
because they don't give you cancer, we haven't discovered it yet, you know. So, I mean, that would actually be more edgy than now saying behind the picket fence lurked great horror. Ever since David Lynch's camera went down into the grass of the suburban lawn and found cockroaches eating each other's heads off, everything else has been a footnote.
Dear Bert and Ernie, having been an avid cinema goer and podcast listener for many years, I've often struggled to get my wife to enjoy the cinema experience as much as I do. I was pleasantly surprised the other day when she suggested that we go and see Revolutionary Road. She's a big fan of Kate Winslet and Leo in Titanic and was no doubt expecting a similar tale of romance and drama. What a mistake. It is, don't get me wrong, a superbly powerful film featuring surprisingly good performances by both Ms. Winswept and Leo. And it did well at dealing with some difficult themes about relationships, individuality, and how life flits between hope and reality. That said, it is, and then in bold, without doubt, the worst film ever to go and see as husband and wife. It takes all the negative aspects of married life, bundles them up, amplifies them, and throws them all over the audience before slam dunking a tragic denouement that literally left us both stunned. One slight moment of light relief came when Kate and Leo's characters announced their plans to take a boat across the Atlantic, at which point my wife says, I hope there are no icebergs. Anyway, keep up the good work.
Can I just say it in a very shallow way? Everyone's meant to be watching this film thinking, oh, look how shallow and empty their lives are. Look how terrible and empty it all is. And I was sitting there going, great suits and ties. And that car is really nice. And look, it's in mint condition. So actually, I had that type of thing. I looked at it and I didn't see it as a, like, oh, isn't life awful? I thought, wow, I love the design of that period. I'd like to live there. I could do with all the psychological madness and all the rest of it if I could get to drive that car.
Andy Batchelor says, Dear Frank and April, last night I was subjected to Revolutionary Road. Aside from Kate Winslet's performance, the camera work and a couple of nice bits of editing.
Camera work is good.
The film is awful. DiCaprio has definitely got his acting hat on, his big acting hat. He acts right the way through the film. Unfortunately, against such a natural performance from Kate, it is horribly jarring. I'm editing as I go through because this is a thesis. Yeah. The direction is obvious and cliched with some amazingly heavy-handed symbolism. Characters talking about their feelings of hopeless emptiness have to do, and all the, they have to do that in the woods. Can you see the wood for the trees? And the moral of this story, don't try to be different. Life is about doing the safe thing, the safe job, and being unhappy doing it badly, and you'll progress up the ladder. Mm. Finally, in the spirit of who's driving the boat, when Kate runs into the woods following the big bust-up, she leaves in her summer frock with empty hands. Later, she returns to lean against a tree in the back garden and light up a cigarette. Where did she get the fags from? Anyway,
well, she probably, you know, I'm sure that even back then in the, you know, in the age of girdles, I'm sure there were many places.
They're hidden in a girdle, are they? I'll just have a rummage.
I think it's very possible. You could, a multitude of things could be hidden under those. There was, the 50s were great. The designs were, everything was great.
Thanks, Quiff Boy. Scott in Birmingham. Sorry, strawberry beer is lovely and it is for men. Let's canvas this. Steve Killick, Hoegaarden Grand Cru at a mind-bending 11% proof is for me. Makes the ordinary Hoegaarden look only fit for weak, wet and weedies. Just a quick word on Revolutionary
Real
Radio.
Real men
just
drink wheat lager.
Ian in Chorley, or is it Ian Chorley? Not sure. Kate and Leo, for my last five cinema trips, I've had to sit through the Revolutionary Road trailer.
Oh, really?
And it's left me thoroughly depressed. Why would I want to pay to watch a couple who don't get on, are stuck in dead-end jobs, and the poor woman has to put the bins out? I can watch that in my own street. Can Mark give me a reason to watch it?
Yeah, great ties, really good electric blue suits, terrific cars, nicely mowed lawns, and good haircuts.
What else is new?
Other than that, let's do The Broken, which is it's a film which has invoked the word stylish. People referring to it as stylish. Lena Headey, is a woman who has a... She's in a car crash. And she has a car crash after seeing her own doppelganger, a reflection of herself, somewhere else in the street. So there's a version of herself out there, like a mirror image of herself out in the world. After the accident, she starts to believe strange things, notably that the people that she knows aren't really the people that she knows. Stop me if you've heard this one.
I don't think Stefan is my boyfriend.
Well, we all have different relationships until we find the one.
No, he looks like him, but he's not him.
Right. When did you first notice this change? After the accident? Do you think then that maybe he really is Stefan and that you're just still confused about the events surrounding the crash?
Dr. Zachman.
Robert, please.
Robert. The man in the apartment is not my boyfriend.
Okay, so let's just do the checklist, okay? So the person I know is not the person I know is Invasion of the Body Snatchers. People in mirrors, coming out of mirrors, doppelgangers. Well, that's a film called Mirrors, which incidentally is a remake of a Korean movie called Into the Mirror. There's a bit in it in which she goes up into the attic with a torch, which is The Exorcist. There's a lot of reflective surfaces in water, which is Don't Look Now and Shivers. There are lots
of
tracking...
Could be on Golden Pond as well.
On Golden Pond, yeah. Lots of tracking shots which suggest that you think he's Stanley Kubrick. And then there's a woman gets murdered in the shower, maybe. Which I think you can fill in the blanks yourself. Now, directed by Sean Ellis, who made an award-winning short that was then expanded into a feature, which was one of the most misogynist films I have ever seen in my life, called Cashback, about this guy who can freeze time. And he freezes time. And
we did that on the programme.
He's an artist, yeah. And so he freezes time, and then he undresses women and looks at them, and then he puts their clothes back on so they don't know. So he's like... I mean, it's a plot that's up there with The Invisible Maniac. He's out of sight and out of his mind. And yet a lot of people went, oh, stylish. Stylish. It's incredible how, if you've got a fashion photography past, people say stylish rather than people say sexist. Sexist, misogynist, chauvinist, twaddle. Now, this doesn't have the problems that that does have in terms of its gender politics, because its gender politics aren't hideous and obnoxious. They're just sort of non-existent. And it is stylish, but it is that classic thing about triumph of style over substance. And it's also a film which looks to me... Now, this is a presumption, OK? There is a habit of people dabbling in the horror genre, and the greatest example of it is John Boorman making Exorcist II: The Heretic, thinking that they're above the horror genre and not really understanding the way in which horror genre uses quotations. I mean, horror genre is constantly nodding to members of the audience. It's a very, very sort of self-reflexive genre. But people from outside the genre come in and do things. They don't really understand the rules of engagement. And I may be wrong about this because I don't know the director from a hole in the ground, although I did see his previous film. I think that he doesn't really know the difference between derivative and homage. And
what is the difference between derivative and homage?
Well, homage is knowing... You know that there's that phrase... Now, hang on, I'll get this right.
Lovingly reverential.
No, maybe? There's that phrase which is talent borrows, genius steals. Is that right? Is that what it is? Fine. Okay. Well, in the case of the horror genre, there's a way of nodding towards, things when you know that something is a reference to something else and you know the audience knows. There's also a way of doing it when you think you're the only person who knows. And there's also another way of doing it which you think nobody knows at all and you're getting away with it. And my problem with Broken, which it is stylish, and the man does have an eye. He certainly does have an eye, which is, because he's a photographer and he has a fashion photographer's eye, which is a fairly voyeuristic eye. But there we go. That's what comes with the territory. And congratulations incidentally to the sound department, because the sound department on The Broken really are the people that should get the bravos, because they've done all the really hard work. The rest of it is just a lot of mirrors and not a whole lot else. And for certain bits of it, I thought, okay, yeah, you know, I was so worried that he was going to make yet another misogynist movie that when he didn't, I kind of forgave him. But it is absolutely in one ear and out the other, and there's nothing going on. Let me very briefly mention Nick and Nora's Infinite Playlist, which stars Michael Cera, who's just been nominated for a BAFTA in the forthcoming BAFTAs for the Rising Star Award thing. And Michael Cera is the guy who's known for playing the geeky kid in loads of movies in which he plays a geeky kid. So he's in Juno. He's the boyfriend who's geeky. And he's in lots of those kind of other type movies in which he plays the geeky guy. And in this thing, he plays a geeky guy. And the geeky guy's broken up with his girlfriend, who's not geeky, but he keeps making mixtapes all the same, and he doesn't realise that their relationship is finished. Then he meets up with another girl who's a slightly misfit girl, and together they have a kind of Into the Night-like experience in which they sort of go off in search of this music venue thing which might be happening or might not, and they have little sort of, you know, interactions with each other in which they kind of like each other, but they don't. And he's very geeky. You know what? It's got some quite poor reviews, but I quite like Michael Cera. He's good at doing the kind of geeky, nerdy, noodly, you know, hey, like me, hug me, cuddle me, you know, embrace me. And Ellen Page said that he's absolutely wonderful, and I'm willing to believe that he is. I mean, he's certainly he's certainly a charming screen presence. I think that he may have got to the point with Nick and Nora's Infinite Playlist, which I thought was fine. If you saw it on an aeroplane, you'd think it was absolutely fine, in which that particular scene seems to have been mined to the point of extinction. I don't really want to see him do another, you know, geeky misfit offbeat, you know, hanging around kooky funny car with an odd misfit girl who he's kind of has but hasn't, you know, got it together with. So line under that now. But Nick and Nora was fine.
So our movie of the week then would be what?
Well, you know, I'm tempted to say
though,
no.
It's got to be that.
I'm tempted to say JCVD.
Don't say JCVD.
I think it is actually, because at least JCVD, there were things in it that were slightly unexpected. Whereas in Revolutionary Road, it was dot the I's, cross the T's.
We'll keep the Underworld Correspondents for next week. Thanks for all the emails. We'll get to some of them again next Friday. Have a great weekend.
Thanks for downloading this BBC Radio 5 Live podcast. And if you like this, you might also like this.
Fighting Talk.
I want to know what the greatest winter sport is. Right, a bit of a cold snap in the studio today, actually. Let's just get Mark and Tom out of the way here. Mark?
I think ice hockey is a great sport. We've had it briefly mentioned by Greg. It's really underrated here. Largely because our teams have all got stupid names, like Basingstoke Bison, for example.
Come on.
Or Nottingham Panthers.
For details of other 5 Live podcasts, go to the website bbc.co.uk/5live or go to the podcast directory in iTunes and search for 5 Live.
Thanks for downloading from the BBC. To find other downloads or more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live.